At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Thank you so much for tuning in to a brand new episode of Knowing is Knowing. I'm your host, Rashad Young, and as always, I appreciate you all tuning in to a brand new episode. Today, I have special guest, Jason Whitlock. Jason is a sports columnist, formerly worked at ESPN, and currently the podcast host of the Fearless Podcast, which you can find out on YouTube. I was so grateful for this conversation because I got a chance to really meet somebody who I consider successful in this space. And it's not necessarily about the success that's important. It's really humanizing the experience of those who aren't successful, because I do believe that anybody who is successful currently has had some sort of hardship or road less traveled to get to where they are today. This interview really inspired me, really humanized him as a person. And if you don't know who he is, I'd be very surprised. But if you do, always make sure to check out this content. And as always, I appreciate you guys. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite audio platform or check me out on YouTube at Rashad Young. Hope you guys have a great week. Until next time, peace.
Mr. Whitlock, how we doing?
Mr. Young, I'm doing great.
Good, good. Appreciate you. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation, this interview. I'm super excited. One, to just get to know you a little bit more. I know you're very good friends with my father. And so
Dad's like a brother and a big brother and a mentor. It's one of the best people I know. And I'm saying I'd say that behind his back. I'd tell anybody. I talk about your dad on the show, so. Your dad's an inspiration, man.
There's nobody like TC. So I'm super excited for this one. When I knew I had the opportunity to talk to you, I had so many questions that came to my mind. One, I'm not a journalist at all. So this whole realm that I've gotten into is something I just kind of picked up naturally over time. But I think for you having the traditional journalist route, I think it's really cool for people to kind of humanize the people that are in these spaces that people wish they could be in. And I want to just talk more about this.
What were you supposed to be doing? What did you go to school for?
We can talk about me too. So no, originally I started off as a chemistry major. So I wanted to be a pharmacist. I had all the ideas of being a pharmacist, young, driving nice cars, things like that. Almost failed out of school. Switched over to education. So I taught briefly in elementary. And now I'm in the route of being a therapist right now. I've written a couple books and things of that nature. So taking several different routes, but podcasting, interviewing people. I've been doing this for the past couple of years. I honestly got to a point in October where I'm like, I'm kind of done. I just was kind of done with doing it because, you know, as I'm sure you know, the space of getting to a certain place, you don't, where you don't see the fruits of your labor at a certain period of time. You kind of ask yourself, is there a different route? And like I said, I'm finishing up school to be a therapist right now. So I know that's kind of the avenue I've been in, getting into speaking and things of that nature. But I think God talked to me one day, man, and give it another shot. And I started using the Threads app and asking people to interview, man. And probably over 100 plus people have reached out. Probably got 50, 60 interviews after this one. So things happen for a reason. But I've always known that interviewing is something I really kind of enjoyed. I like to just get to know people and their stories, man. I just like to know how people work in this world, what makes them who they are, and also to give people kind of a sense of inspiration for those who are trying to be in the positions that maybe you were in or others that I've kind of gotten a chance to get to know, man. So that's just a little bit about me.
Always be a student of life, and that sounds like what you're trying to be. And, I mean, that's a never-ending journey.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's kind of the whole point of the podcast itself is just me understanding that I don't know everything. It is just constantly learning. The last person I just had, it's about an hour ago. She's a finance lady, very successful in the finance space. Hearing her story, how she got into it, I just try to find a way to humanize people and their experiences. You know, when somebody thinks of somebody like you, they can see the followers, they can see the platform, and they can just think, oh, this guy doesn't have a story behind him. He doesn't have anything. He doesn't have a human connection because he's so separated from other people. And so my ultimate goal is, again, to try to humanize you all and you all's experience, man. So hopefully that help you understand me a little bit more.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. So tell me a little bit about you, man, your story, your journey. How do we get to this place today of Jason Whitlock, the guy, the sports columnist, the podcast guy, you know, very big in the media space?
Poor little ghetto child from Indianapolis, Indiana, you know, who was blessed with two tremendous parents and a brother, and then eventually blessed with a step family and step sister and step brother and stepmother. And just, you know, my parents divorced when I was 5, 6 years old. And, you know, me and my brother and mother lived in the inner city in Indianapolis, a little bitty tiny apartment on the east side of Indianapolis. And, you know, our apartment that we were living in, or I don't even know if you call it an apartment, it's kind of a flat, it got robbed. Someone broke into it, climbed through the window. With me and my brother were over with my dad and my stepmom and my stepbrothers and sisters, but my mother was home alone, and she didn't tell us what happened when we came back. She just ended up saying, hey, we're moving. It's too dangerous. And you know, I got to take another job. I got to work some overtime. And she moved us out to a working class suburb farther on the east side. And it was there that I really blossomed as kind of an athlete, and just kind of a popular kid. It was compared to where we were living, this was like, I was like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, where there was actual apartment complex, had a swimming pool. It had a lake where you could fish and outdoor basketball courts. And so for someone like me that was into athletics, it's like I was never at home. I was always out playing pickup football, pickup basketball, well, baseball. And eventually I became, you know, the high school had a very good high school football program, Warren Central. And we live almost right across the street from the high school. And I became a high school football star at Warren Central and was ended up being the captain of my high school's first state championship team. And Jeff George was a kid that I grew up with on the Far East Side. And he was our quarterback, who was eventually was the number one overall pick, I believe, in the 1990 NFL draft. And so, you know, that team, we won the state. We were nationally ranked. I got a football scholarship to Ball State. And that's where I met guys like Stanford Young and a bunch of other guys. But it's also where I figured out how to be an adult and started figuring out, like, what I wanted to do in life. When I originally went to college, you know, I thought I would be an accountant, and I didn't know anything about accounting. I just knew that my dad owned a inner city bar, and he used to mention that his accountant used to do this or do that. And so I said, oh, I'll be an accountant, because I'm telling you, I didn't know anything about college. I got in a math class my freshman year of college and was like, oh, I'm not meant for accounting. And a friend who went to high school with me and had known me for a long time, he was a couple years older than me at Ball State. And he was like, hey, man, you should be a journalist. You should be a sports writer. You read the newspaper every day. That's one of your passions. You should be a sports writer. And so after, you know, my first semester at Ball State, I changed my major to journalism. And, you know, thank God that I did.
No. It's always good when you have that realization that we should be somewhere else. So, I mean, I know the journalism route is so long. There's so many routes that you can go. Did you knew that you want to get into sports? You want to be a sports columnist? Or did you kind of bounce around from different ideas? Were you like a beat writer, you know, things like that?
I certainly worked all the different jobs. But when I switched my major to journalism, I have been this avid reader of the newspaper. I used to bring the newspaper into the locker room and protect it at all costs because, you know, between practices, games, whatever, I would read the newspaper. And there was a guy that used to was a syndicated columnist out of Chicago named Mike Royko that the Indianapolis papers used to run. And so I would read his column. And so when I switched my major, this is not a joke. I was like, this is 1985, 1986. And I say, I want to be like Mike. And not Jordan, but Mike Royko. And Royko was a columnist, and that's what I wanted to do. But he was not a sports columnist. He was kind of a generalist. And I wanted to be the Mike Royko of sports writing. And so that's how I set my sights. And so, I say I set my sights, but you know, your dad would tell you, and any guy that went to college with me would tell you, I mostly socialized at Ball State. I was kind of a big dumb jock and was a bit of a problem for the coaches and was a very immature kid. And so Ball State grew me up. Unlike your dad, who was had an instant impact at Ball State and lettered all 4 years, the first 2 years they tried to kick me off the team because I was a full-blown idiot. I knew nothing about college. Probably my family had gone off to college. I didn't know what I was doing. I thought I was there to drink beer and poke a little gigi and go to some parties and play some football on the side. And the coaches were very hard on me, tried to run me off the team the first 2 years. I finally started growing up in my third year, started having success on the football field. Very successful my fourth year. The team we played on in 1988 should have won the MAC championship, and I was a very good player, a decent player on that team. And I had a chance to I could have come back for my fifth year and played football, but I didn't want. I'm not going to be a pro football player. I've got a torn ACL that I played with my entire fourth year of football at Ball State. And I was like, hey, man, if you're going to actually do something after college, you better get focused real quick, because I was a guy that probably going into my fifth and final year of school, I probably had a 2.08 GPA. I mean, I had just been sliding by in between shaking off hangovers and playing a little football. I put very little work into school. And so my fifth year, I just dedicated myself to school and journalism. I started writing for the student newspaper. And I was playing catch up. I was behind, but I enjoyed it. I loved it. I remember thinking like, oh, man, my whole life is going to be built around just going to sporting events and writing about it. And I thought that would be awesome. And I can remember I had a professor, Dr. Timothy Kambula, who had worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And he told us, I can remember this is 1988, 1989. He tells us in class that he made $70,000 a year at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And my eyes lit up. Because I'm $70,000 a year. Oh, and all I had to do is go to sporting events. Oh, I done made it. And so that was my kind of dream. I'm going to be Mike Royko. And eventually, when I'm 30, 40 years old, I'm going to make $70,000 a year writing sports. And that was kind of my fantasy and dream. And I can remember the other, just keeping it all the way real. I think it was May 6th or May 7th of 1990. It's the day before our graduation ceremony. I can remember I'm in the backyard at some little end of school year party. And I can remember telling friends of mine that were in the backyard, man, I'm going to grow up. This will be the last time I smoke some weed. I got to move on with and get real about life. And that's, I don't know, it just kind of clicked. And so the work ethic that I didn't have in football and didn't have for class while I was at Ball, it really clicked in for me when I was like, man, I'm about to move into the real world and I got to make it because it ain't like I got some daddy or mama that's about to give me millions of dollars or even thousands of dollars to make it. I got to do it. And so I just got very serious and very serious about my career and becoming a journalist. And I tell you, Rashad, for young people out there, I wasn't qualified for a full-time job when I left Ball State. I wrote every newspaper in the country. And they looked at my transcripts. I graduated, I think, with like a 2.3 GPA. They looked at my clips that I was writing at the student paper, and they were like, hey, bro, decent effort, but you're just not qualified for a full-time job. And so the only newspaper that would offer me any opportunity was the Bloomington Herald Times in Bloomington, Indiana. And they offered me a part-time job for $5 an hour. So I was the first person in my family to go off to college and graduate. And my reward was a $5 an hour job at the Bloomington Herald Times. But I thought it was a great opportunity. And so I took it. And you know, there's a lot of lessons in that for young people. It's like, if you can get out of college without being burdened with a bunch of responsibilities, why was I able to take that job? I didn't have kids. I didn't have baby mama or baby that I had to take care of. I could take some super entry-level job, go set up shop in a one-room efficiency in Bloomington, Indiana, and put the work in to make myself into a journalist. And that's what I did.
Man, that's the story right there. I know that's just the beginning of how we get to that point. $5 an hour. So how long would you be in this space? Like in this, like how long would you work a day? Like how many hours would you work doing that?
At the Bloomington Herald Times, all I did was work. You're making $5 an hour. You're living in a one-room efficiency. You know, you don't have the money to have a social life. You're a tiny bit desperate. And so all I would do is work. And they literally, eventually further along in my career, when people would write stories about me and how I came about, they would ask the people back in Bloomington, you know, what was Whitlock like when he started out? And their sports editor, Bob Hamill, would tell the story that, hey, man, we looked at Whitlock's work early on and was like, holy cow, this guy may not make it. And he said that they were close to kind of giving up on me. And then he said, because Bob Hamill was this legendary sports writer in Indiana, and he had a legendary work ethic. And he said that he told, and it's true, he told me, he was like, hey, man, you need to read this column by James Kilpatrick. It comes out once a week, and he gives advice about writing. And he told me that, let's say, at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And then by the time he got done with his work at 1 a.m., he's leaving the building. He's generally the last person to leave. And he's as he's walking out, he sees one light on at a desk, and it's me reading back columns of James Kilpatrick. And he said, oh, my God, Whitlock actually wants this. This isn't just some jock that thinks he wants to be a sports writer. He actually wants this, and I did. And I'm so appreciative they gave me that opportunity. It allowed me to get to a point where I was qualified for entry-level work, a full-time job in the newspaper business, and the Charlotte Observer gave me that entry-level job working in a bureau they had at that time in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And man, they just threw so much money at me. $403 a week they paid me to move to Rock Hill, South Carolina and write about peewee sports and high school sports. And I thought I'd hit the lottery. $403 a week, man.
How long did you do that after? So you went from Indiana to Charlotte. How long did you do that?
I was in Bloomington for a year, and I was in Charlotte or Rock Hill for about 18 months. Because when I got to Charlotte, one, they had great editors there, but they also had enough of a staff that the editors could take the time to work with me on a daily basis as I developed. And it was an incredible experience because we had this editor, his name was Bill O'Connor. He was kind of rough around the edges, kind of the stereotypical newspaper guy. He talked kind of gruff and he was very aggressive with his feedback. It didn't bother me because I was a former football player and I was used to football coaches talking crazy to me. And so what this guy and his straightforward approach worked well for me. Some people, I said, he would break them. He'd make them cry. He did all kinds of stuff. But for me, it was what I needed. And within about 3 months of being in Rock Hill, working with Bill O'Connor, all the lights went off. I figured it out. I became a much better writer. And my career in the time I was there in 18 months, I accomplished incredible things. Things that no one was into, getting all these front page newspaper stories.
Right.
Back during the time when newspapers really mattered. And I would be getting front page stories on the entire front of the Charlotte Observer, which was a pretty big newspaper at that time. And that's kind of where my just career took off. There were some people, an editor at the Ann Arbor News that caught wind of, hey, there's a young guy in at the Charlotte Observer that's doing well. See if he's interested in covering the Fab Five basketball team at the University of Michigan. And so that was my big break, covering Chris Webber and Juwan Howard and Jalen Rose, and Ray Jackson and Jenny King. And that kind of put me into the spotlight. That
I'm like,
Fab Five, major, major story. You know, that they were the Beatles of basketball and I got to cover it and started getting the attention of the national media and kind of made a name for myself. And did that for 2 years and started covering the Michigan football program too, which was clearly a big deal. And that's kind of what put my name on the map. I'll never forget, you know, Michigan's having all these big basketball games. And I'll never forget, like, Dick Vitale referenced me on a broadcast of a Michigan basketball game and talking about a story that I had written in the paper. And that's when I was like, holy cow. Dick Vitale was talking about ESPN. This is incredible.
So with the Fab Five, what was like the biggest thing you learned with having all that, one, their big media attention, but like what did you learn as a journalist with covering all that attention about them as people potentially?
So now you turn it into them as people. Let me tell a different ad. Let me answer it a different way.
Sure.
What I learned was that with a big story like that and all the attention is like people will cut corners to make a name for themselves as it relates to covering a team with that kind of attention. And I'm not saying this to take a shot at anyone. I'm just telling you factually because my whole approach to the media has been like, hey, man, the media is not being truthful with you. I'm going to be truthful with you. And I saw firsthand that a very popular columnist or well-known, a guy named Mitch Albom. I don't know if you're too young to remember when Mitch Albom was a really big deal in the sports media. He was the biggest deal in the sports media. And I can remember he wrote a story, he wrote a book talking about the Fab Five and said that Chris Webber was bringing all this money to Michigan. And he couldn't even afford a Big Mac at McDonald's. And I read this and I said, are you kidding me? We watched Chris Webber drive up to basketball practice in a brand new SUV every day. I've been to Chris Webber's apartment. It's plush. I mean, I went there and played video games with him one day for a story. Living far better than me. And, you know, not that I was living great, but, you know, I was a 24, 25-year-old kid, probably at that time making $45,000, $50,000. And this is early 1990s. Wasn't doing bad. I go into Chris Webber's apartment. I'm like, holy, this 19, 20-year-old dude is living the life. It's my apartment. And I'm like, and Mitch Almas pretending like these guys – they can go anywhere on campus and eat for free. Well, what world is he living in And so that was kind of my first real introduction into like, man, the media loves narrative and they really don't care about the facts. As it relates to learning about those guys, I was always really super impressed with Juwan Howard. He was kind of the glue and the leader of that team in a kind of an unstated way. Weber and Jalen Rose got most of the attention, but I was always super impressed with Juwan Howard. I thought Ray Jackson was a really solid guy. Obviously, Jalen Rose had a huge personality. And you know, as I sit with these 57-year-old eyes now, I look at Chris Weber and again, having grown up with Jeff George, another super talented athlete, it was just another example of what athletic celebrity, how it makes it's too much for young people. You know, Chris Weber, not that he's some sort of a victim, but, you know, what came crashing down on him after he called that timeout, I think it shaped his personality, made him a bit more introverted, changed him a tiny bit, made him a bit more cynical. You know, and I saw things that happened with Jeff George through his football career, early in college, early in the NFL. These young people get all of this attention, all this money, all this fame, and it really takes a toll on them. You know, hats off to the guys that, you know, can handle it and come out on the other side okay. But it chips away and makes you a tiny bit cynical. There is a price for all of that fame and attention. And that's I understood it a little bit then. I understand it a lot now in retrospect.
Yeah, and that kind of also helps me in today's time. And curious about your perspective. What are your thoughts on just the NIL experience for athletes? Do you think that has made it? I know you're a vocal guy. I know you got various opinions. I do know that NIL is a very interesting space. And I'm always curious to know, like, from that perspective, do you think it has made it worse for the sport itself, for people, the fame, the attention, all those things?
I literally, you know, we got a Ball State text thread that your dad's in, and I literally... You just had a discussion about, like, if name, image, and likeness in the transfer portal were around in our day, would these bonds, these friendships that we've had now for a lifetime, would they even be allowed to develop, cultivate, grow, happen? Because, you know, there's a handful of us that would have probably transferred out after 2 years. There's another handful that would have transferred out as seniors or fifth year players. And for someone like me, this is what I think about name, image, and likeness. I didn't have a dime in my pocket when I was at Ball State, and I was completely uncontrollable. If someone had given me $5,000, $10,000, $1 million, I would be dead right now, Rashad. And I say that all serious. I would have done something so incredibly stupid, and I would have developed habits and I would be depressed, because here's what I worry about. Not with Shedeur Sanders, Travis Hunter, these guys, they're going to have long NFL careers and going to make a lot of money in the future. But a lot of these guys are going to peak financially at 19, 20 years old. And will develop habits and desires based on, man, I was making $100,000 when I was in college for playing football. Will that guy be willing to do what I did at 22 and say, no, I'm gonna take this $5 an hour job and work my way up? Or because if I had made $100,000 in college, I'd be like, ain't no way. I'm gonna start at the bottom. And blah, blah, blah. And so the journey that I went on at the very bottom, $5 an hour to earning seven-figure salaries, stuff like that, guys aren't going to do that because they will have peaked in college. Depression will jump on them when, like, the reality of, like, no, this is what, you know, a career really looks like and how it unfolds. And so I'm actually glad I'm not in this era. And I don't think the people that are in this era fully realize the repercussions of, you know, throwing a bunch of money at kids. Money doesn't solve problems. It really doesn't. You got to live long enough to fully figure that out. It's impossible to understand in your 20s, 30s, or sometimes even your 40s. But by the time you get to my age, you really have money in perspective. And there's a process to acquiring wealth that people need to go through so that when they get it, they actually don't blow it. I'll give you an example, Shah. When I can remember in 1995, was the first time I started making more than $100,000 a year. And for a little ghetto kid like me, you got to go all the way back to 1995. $100,000, that's a lot of money for a little ghetto kid in 1995. And I can remember running out and buying a big gold chain. And I had this emblem made called The League. And it was, you know, brothers that made six figures legally. It was blah, blah, blah. Rashad, I promise you, I wore that necklace twice, put it somewhere in a desk.
Yeah.
Don't know what happened to it. It was a big waste of money. And I look at the young guys that get into the NFL and even college now, everybody's got their gold chains, all this other stuff. And I'm just like, oh God, I wish I could just talk to them about, hey, put that in the stock market. Hey, buy some real estate, buy assets that appreciate. They're young, and I used to be young and just as dumb. And so, and you know, not that my parents were dumb, but, you know, my dad didn't graduate high school. My mom was a factory worker. You know, again, I'm the first person in my family to go off to college. I didn't have this institution of knowledge to fall back on and someone to say, nah, Jason, here's what you should do, blah, blah, blah. And that's what's happening to a lot of these kids. And they're turning kids into adults and into the primary providers for their parents and aunts and uncles and cousins. It's a lot of pressure. And so they throw on the gold chains. They go out and buy a Maybach or some kind of fancy car. And it looks glamorous from the outside. Those kids got headaches, man. Being the primary provider for your family, even at 57, it's hard. And at 18, 19, 20 years old, it's nearly impossible.
So what do you think is a solution to something like that? When there is, you know, athletes are going into the league earlier, rather it's football, baseball, basketball. Like, how do you think we change that narrative to help them be more successful in that space? Because I'm sure you know most athletes after they retire, most of them go broke very quickly.
Can't put the toothpaste back in the bottle. You know, the kind of things I was arguing 20, 25, 30 years ago was like, hey, man, there are some college athletes who are worthy of being paid more than their scholarship. And we should figure out a way to compensate those guys, but tie it to academic achievement. And it's like you get this big balloon payment upon graduation, and this money has been put somewhere, placed into an investment, an annuity or an IRA, something that's handed to them at graduation, not so they can all go out and buy gold chains while they're in college. It's no doubt. I'll tell another funny story just about the dumb stuff we do when we're young. You get to be about 21, your fourth year in college, and the credit card companies start preying on you. They start sending you applications for credit cards. And I'll never forget getting a Visa in 1988, I believe. And the first thing I did, and again, this is a little ghetto kid, but the first thing I did was I took all my boys to Red Lobster for a big dinner. It's about eight of us. Y'all go to Red Lobster, we eating high on the hog for us. And Rashad, I probably didn't pay that off. So that happened in 1988 with interest and all that other stuff. I probably didn't pay it off until 92, 93, 94, or around there, clearing all the credit card. Because then they got me with one credit card. Next thing you know, I got a second credit card. Now I got a Visa and a MasterCard while I'm in college. It's stupidity. It's insanity. But that's what young people do.
No, it is. And it's something that we always continue to learn, which I think is really cool. So from the journalism side, you've done it all. I mean, you worked in the biggest networks. What do you think has been the biggest takeaway in your experience just navigating through all these different spaces?
For me, Rashad, I've seen the media change so much. Obviously, I graduated college in 1990. And so in the 90s, again, you figure out that there's some corruption, there's some dishonesty in the legacy media, but there's also a reverence for truth and objectivity, and you could be bold and speak and write things that not everyone liked back then, and you could uncover truths that rattled and shook up the establishment. I've seen all of that change. To where the worst thing that could be printed or spoken is the truth. And then for me, someone who grew up connected to Christianity and connected to the church, as I matured in my faith, I started figuring out, like, holy cow, the corporate media, the legacy media, so the big legacy brands, they don't want you anywhere near Jesus Christ. They don't want you anywhere near referencing, talking about biblical truth. And so for me, that once I figured that out, that like, oh, a lot of the reason I get a lot of friction in corporate legacy media is because of my connection to Jesus Christ. That's when I was like, oh, I got to get out of here. I got to get somewhere where I can talk about my Lord and Savior and not have anybody looking at me cross-eyed or throwing banana peels at me. And so that's what's made me move into the independent media space and step away from corporate television, because it had just become way too hostile to a biblical worldview. And just the athletes all the time thank their Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, but no one ever has that conversation with them. Well, how did Jesus Christ help you today? No one wants to really ask Jameis Winston a follow-up question about his journey and his faith and blah, blah. I do. And so in order to be able to have that conversation and that examination, I had to build my own media platform and company where I can talk about whatever I want. And as long as I'm willing to deal with the ramifications, because again, YouTube, their algorithms, they don't like it any more than corporate media. But you know, I'm good. I figured out a business strategy that works and allows me to earn while still being able to be true to my faith.
Yeah. So talking about, I was actually gonna get to your faith actually at some point. When did this journey begin with faith? Did you grow up a very religious guy? Did your faith waver at some point? Like I'm sure most people do. How does your relationship with God get stronger as time went?
I grew up in a little tiny church in Indianapolis, church my grandmother belonged to, church my mother and auntie and family belonged to. I grew up with that vacation Bible school, the whole nine. Going to church on Sundays and Wednesdays and all that. Stepped out on my own, got off to college, and, you know, I strayed. You know, I wanted to live in the world and experience all that the world had to offer. And then I got drunk on my success as a media person and started making a lot of money and became famous. And now I'm on TV. And it's like I still had my faith, but my faith wasn't guiding me. It was something that I had in the background while I celebrated my financial success and celebrity and access to go to this sporting event and that sporting event and interact with this celebrity and that celebrity. And I became a person that really, really displeased God is what I would have to say. And with, you know, without going into, well, I mean, again, I talk about it all the time on my show. You know, there wasn't a strip club in Vegas or Miami or LA that didn't know me. And, you know, I made it rain there. I was the typical celebrity idiot. And eventually I just figured out, like, this is stupid. This is an affront to God. This isn't who you are. This will undermine your salvation. And also I just figured out that even though there were still parts of me that were very, very biblical, and that caused a lot of friction for me at ESPN and to a lesser degree at Fox Sports. And so in 2013, I believe, I went back to ESPN for the second time, and it was to run the platform called The Undefeated Sports website led by Black journalist. I was the leader of it. And quite honestly, the leftist Black journalist hated me because I was more of a conservative journalist because of my allegiance to God and my biblical values. And I got attacked and smeared in a way in 2013, 14, and 15. Articles written about me, like Deadspin and others, that just really smeared my character. And then that's when I figured out, like, oh, you better get white with God, because their problem isn't really with you. You're nothing. It's the values you carry, your allegiance to Jesus Christ. And if you don't strengthen your relationship with him, you're going to get all the way destroyed. And so in 2013, 14, 15, that's when I was like, Whitlock, start getting right with God, you know, change course. And it's been a steady progress all the way to, you know, in 2020, I left Fox Sports. I left Los Angeles. So it was like, man, I got to get back to real civilization where I can have the values that I have without being an outsider. And so I moved to Nashville and, you know, started Fearless and started, you know, the Fearless Movement and surrounded myself with other men who, you know, have a passion for Jesus Christ and want to, I'm trying to create content around sports and entertainment and politics that doesn't violate people's Christian values. There's so little content, you know, and I'm not trying to offend anybody, but I'm just going to keep it real. You turn on most movies, particularly directed at us as Black people, and you know, the next thing you know, there's going to be some LGBTQ narrative that's front and center. And there's going to be some sort of victim narrative, how Black people are victims. And I just reject victimhood because I can't be a victim if I'm on Jesus's team. It just can't happen. And so I'm trying to create content that people find entertaining and can discuss and analyze sports and politics and the world without it being an affront to a biblical perspective, trying to give believers content that they can find entertaining, they can share with their family, their kids, other believers, because, you know, the whole system seems to be rigged against us.
No, I was well said. That was well said. It makes complete sense to take a step out on faith and to stay strong to what your belief is, regardless of what the world said. And I appreciate that. I did have a final question for you as we were wrapping up. As I ask all my guests, what does it mean to be human to you?
What does it mean to be human to me? Huh. Being human to me just means that, you know, I'm an image bearer of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, and that being human, I guess, for me just means engaging in the constant struggle to obey God, to fear and obey God. That's what being human means to me. You know, I'm sure others have a different way of looking at it, but that's I think it's my job to fear and obey God and let the chips fall where they may from there.
Well, sir, I appreciate you as always just taking the time out, man. I know people know who you are, but for those who don't know, where can they find you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter or X at Whitlock Jason. You can find me on Instagram at Real Jason Whitlock. You should find me on YouTube at youtube.com/Jason Whitlock. And you can find me here in Nashville, Tennessee, developing a passion for country music.
I like that. We're
rap no more. I used to listen back. I just can't do it.
I completely understand. Well, Mr. Whitlock, as always, sir, again, I appreciate you taking to that time. For those who are listening, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, any favorite audio platform. As always, more conversations with more amazing people coming soon. Till next time, peace.
All right.